Yep, let's do this. Tim Hasselbeck every Wednesday at high noon. Timmy, what's going on?
What's up? How are you?
What's new and exciting in your world? Ready for a little football?
Ready for football? Yep. Got a couple game assignments for my college responsibilities for next week. And also getting ready for some NFL coverage. Going to figure out how I'm going to, view the games. Because I haven't watched NFL games from home in 10 years.
Wow.
So I have to figure out how I'm going to get that set up.
So you've been in Bristol?
Got a lot going on. I typically watch games in a big room that we call the War Room. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, it's a big wall with every game and everything you could ever, imagine in terms of, needing to, see what's going on. So, need to try to replicate that.
Are you allowed to let the cat out of the bag on any of your college games, or does that need to be hush hush for now?
I don't know that it needs to be hush hush. I guess I'll just put it this way, not set in stone, but I believe you guys know I do games on the ACC network, and the season kicks off with Miami versus University of Alabama Birmingham, and then there's a game Saturday, which is Western Kentucky at Louisville. So, some close by teams that I might get the chance to look at.
And so you're doing this you're doing this in studio? Are you going? What was the setup again?
Well, so it depends. It depends. Some games will be broadcast from home. Like, remember some of the Korean baseball stuff?
Yes.
You probably had seen, and Carl Ravitch and, guys were doing some stuff from home. So sometimes that will be the case, and sometimes people will be, at the stadium. I think it all kind of all depends on where people are located, the ability to travel. There's a lot of factors that go into it. And so, I know that the people at ESPN have done kind of an amazing job of just even trying to figure out what is possible and what's not possible. And obviously, the slate of games will be different with some of these conferences not playing.
Right.
But there's still enough to logistically try to pull off, right? So, I just kind of give you an example. I know, I think it was Greg McElroy or somebody, I saw an interview that he did where basically he was saying, like, if he were to, this was before the Pac-12 had kind of postponed their season, but he's like, look, if I was going to try to get to Washington State, he would have to leave, at a certain time just to get there with so many airlines canceling flights. And then, typically you have responsibilities. Like, I have NFL responsibilities on Sundays. So, if I were to go somewhere to call a game, I would have to get to a place where I could see the game and then also be ready to be on TV. And, with the current kind of airline schedule, it's not the same. So there's a lot that needs to be figured out. And I think people have worked really hard on it. And, I'm just trusting that they all have a pretty good solution for it, which I'm sure they do.
Leonard Fournette, just to be released, what were your thoughts about the Jags just saying goodbye? We can't get anything for you. Goodbye.
I mean, I'm shocked because now maybe it's his salary, he's 25 years old, had over 1,000 yards rushing last year, as a top five pick when he came out. Like, I'm surprised. Now, I would think that there's more to the story than that, especially when you look at Jacksonville's running back situation. Like, there's not a team that needs a running back more than Jacksonville. When you look at their current roster, they have Chris Thompson, who's a change of pace back, and then, a couple of guys that, don't have a combined, 210 yards, in career rushing. So, to me, something else is up from, like, a I don't know. I mean, I know that he's had issues with the team before about his injuries, and, you know, it hasn't exactly always been smooth sailing there. So I'm surprised that he wasn't claimed. Would have really thought that he would have been, and I feel like there's more to the story here on Leonard Fournette.
If you were the Titans, and the Jags are, I guess, on the hook for $4 million no matter what, right? Even they're going to have to pay him the $4 million?
A dead cap. I don't know that they have to pay him that.
Right.
So I think that's just like dead cap. I don't believe they have to pay him
okay.
that since they're cut.
Okay. So they're just going to – that's just going to count against the cap. Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So for – I don't know what the price – so let's just say – $3-4 million. I don't know what the market's going to bear.
Well,
he wasn't.
Everybody
claimed.
Passed on him for $4 million. So let's figure it's going to be less than that.
Okay, so $3 million. Let's just say the number's $3 million. If you're John Robinson, would you be at least having a discussion in a room with the door shut about Henry and Fournette in your backfield?
Yeah, I'd probably talk about it. You know, the thing that would concern me a little bit is like Leonard Fournette, okay, not being the guy. And not when I say okay, meaning, like, is he going to be a good teammate? You know, I remember talking to Joey Galloway one time. I forget where he went, but basically he went somewhere and he was just going to be a backup. It was at the very end of his career. And so he literally was going to play, like, I don't know, 10 snaps a game. And so he's standing on the sideline, and it's like, okay, you go in for a play, and then, you know, you run a play, and you just run to the flat, and then you come out, and you stand on the sideline for, you know, another 7 plays, and then you go, and he's like, nope, like, this isn't, I can't do this, I'm done. And I know it's a different scenario, a guy late in his career used to be the guy, and Fournette's just 25, but, like, how does that work? How does that work when you have these guys that, like, you know, the argument is they get stronger as the game goes on? Like, you know, you're not going to run the ball 50 times. So I'm not sure that the Titans are a good fit. Like, I would look at Washington and be like, you know, they just had to cut, you know, Geis. They've got a, you know, an older running back in Peterson. Like, maybe that makes sense. Or Seattle or Chicago or... You know, I mean, the Buccaneers, I think there are other places that seem like they would make more sense than the Titans.
I brought to the table that he had 76 receptions last year, which I don't know if a lot of people realize that. That was, I think, fourth best in the league.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody put a claim in on him. That's really surprising.
Willie, the perplexed tone in your voice is exactly what I am thinking. I'm serious. You mentioned that, like, the production is crazy, and he's 25, and he was the fourth overall pick. Like, he came into the league with as much hype as Ezekiel Elliott.
And yeah, I don't know the variables behind the scenes. I don't know what kind of teammate he is. I don't know what kind of person he is. I understand. There's things I don't know. I simply brought it up in a weird year, which we don't know about positive tests throughout the course of a season, or an injury could happen where Derrick Henry misses 2 or 3, 4 games, what have you. And you are a run heavy team. You are predicated on running the football and having success running the football to set up everything else. I would think that would be, if you get him at the right price and it made sense, and I don't know if it makes sense on what kind of person or teammate he is, that would be something of real interest. That'd be the best 1-2 punch in the league. That's the reason I brought it up.
Yeah, I don't think that he's been a very good teammate. I mean, to answer your question, like, I think that's the key. So, he hasn't been. So, you know, I think there's been issues with, is he hurt? Is he not hurt? What's he doing? You know, I think that he hasn't been a good teammate. I don't know the details of it. I don't want to start accusing the guy of things he didn't do, but, look, there's a lot of ways you can be a bad teammate. You know, you don't show up for the team plane. You don't go to treatment. You, you know, you're late for a bunch of things, you know, your interaction with people in the buildings. Like, there are a number of different factors that can lead to not working out, you know. And I just feel like there is something fishy going on here where, you know, Yannick Ngakoue gets traded, basically, you know, gives up $5 million and he gets traded. And then the very next day, you know, Leonard Fournette is just released. Like, to me, like, I just, again, this is total speculation. I'm not reporting this. But, like, that just sounds like an environment where, you know, a good player is furious and is like, wait a second, why are we trading good players? And, you know, like, I'm going to be on the worst team in the league this year, you know, goes off, demands a trade, whatever the situation is, and next thing you know, he's cut. So that's what it feels like to me. I don't know if that's what happened, but again, to Willie's point of, like, no one claimed him, like, what's going on here with Leonard Fournette?
Talking to Tim Hasselbeck. So let's talk about another guy. And Floyd Reese has said the exact same thing in as many words about Jadeveon Clowney. He keeps asking the question, as we've been asking almost every day throughout the center, what's going on with Jadeveon Clowney? He goes, it makes me wonder what is going on. Why does nobody break down the door to sign this guy? What is going on behind the scenes? Why is this guy still out there? But there has been a lot of talk here, Tim, especially with some of the issues the Titans are dealing with. Vic Beasley hasn't gotten on the practice field yet. They really look like they have a need there. And Jadeveon Clowney has been saying all along, I'm going to wait to the last minute to sign. So what do you think? Should the Titans up their price a little bit? If they've been staying low, like everybody says, that, you know, they've lowballed him way less than he wants, What is going to give here? Will somebody go up to get him, or will he have to come down to take an offer somewhere?
Well, I think his price is going to have to go down, or there's going to have to be an injury or something like that. To Floyd's point about, hey, what's going on here? I think it really is about the asking price. You know, we saw it with Logan Ryan, right? I think there was some news out recently where basically, you know, Logan Ryan wanted $10 million a year, and it was like, yeah, you know, not until you drop that price. You drop that price, and all of a sudden you find a home. You know, I think for Clowney, the tricky part is he does have somewhat of an injury history. And so, you know, one of the things I learned from just being around Bill Polian were, you know, when guys are free agents, you know, the two biggest factors are age and health, you know, like then production. I mean, it's just how it goes. So he's been productive, but, like, the health has been a legitimate thing. And not that he's, you know, unhealthy or can't still be productive. I don't even think he's 28 years old yet. I think he can be, but he has been banged up. And then, you know, here comes the production part of it. He had 3 sacks last year. Now, he probably views himself as a double-digit sack guy. The reality is he's never had double-digit sacks in a season. The most he's ever had is 9.5. He had 9 in 2018, and then he had 3 last year. So, you know, if you view yourself as a double-digit sack guy and want to get that type of money, but the rest of the league doesn't view you that way, that's how you're available right now.
We just talked about the Colts in the last hour. How would you compare the Colts and the Titans rosters at this point from where you sit?
Well, I mean, I would think that they're, you know, somewhat similar. I think they're both good. I think, you know, you could probably give the advantage to, you know, each team kind of in certain areas. I think some of them would, you know, could be debatable and up for grabs. But, yeah, I think they're similar teams. I think they're teams that have both improved. I think both teams have drafted well and, you know, have gotten good young players on their teams. And so I think in many respects they're similar. So if you say, okay, well, how does it, you know, end up playing out? You know, who would you prefer? Like, I think some of it comes down to the quarterback play, or a large part of it comes to the quarterback play. Obviously, health's been a big concern for, you know, the Colts. You know, like T.Y. Hilton's injury situation has, you know, I think hurt that team and their production. I think they've linked a lot of wins and losses to when T.Y. is available and when he's not. you know, and so, you know, I mean, that's how I would see them. I think those are two very good rosters.
We're talking to Tim Hasselbeck, ESPN NFL analyst, college football analyst as well. And so along those lines, I'm glad Willie brought that up, because with in the comparisons with the roster, I mean, you when you go through and you look at the Titans and you say Derrick Henry, okay, that guy, like if you're an opponent, that guy scares me. Like you know that he can hurt you if he gets going. But with the comparison of the two, I look at the Colts and I think there are a few of those names that you go, okay, well, DeForest Buckner, he can really hurt me. He scares me. T.Y. Hilton, obviously. Can you look at the Titans roster and make more or make a case for more than Henry of being that type of impact player?
Oh, I think you definitely can. I mean, I think you start a quarterback. If you know, Ryan Tannehill plays the way he did, you know, after taking over last year, then, you know, I would think that that's a playing at a level higher than I would expect Philip Rivers to play at. Look, A.J. Brown, considering what he did as a rookie, yeah, I think A.J. Brown could be one of these guys where people start to look at him, you know, as one of the best receivers in the league. I don't think there's any question that people would feel that way about him. You know, just I know we, you know, kind of have been talking offensive side of the ball, but like, listen, I think everyone knows what Kevin Byard is. Like, he's a difference maker, you know. Does Harold Landry, does he kind of, you know, take that next step? You know, you guys mentioned Vic Beasley. Like, what's the story there? So, I think they're difference makers there. But, look, when you look at the Colts, you know, I think it's a similar thing. Like, Darius Leonard's an amazing player. You know, I think that's significant. You know, offensively, I think Marlon Mack's a way better runner than people realize. And so when he's healthy, he's really, really good. So, yeah, I think both teams have talented players, guys that are difference makers and that the other team is legitimately concerned about.
Tim, what did you make of the comments that Kirk Cousins had? He was on Kyle Brandt's podcast, and basically, you know, he said he wants to respect other people's concerns when it comes to the virus, but he's one of those that he's just going to live his life and do his normal thing. And he's quoted as saying, and if it knocks me out, it knocks me out. I'm going to be okay. You know, even if I die, I die. I kind of have peace about that. What did you make of his comments?
Well, I think that portion of his comments, you know, is getting a lot of play, but what he also said was, you know, basically, look, I'm at a 0.000, you know, 1% of, you know, being, you know, kind of being in that situation where, like, if I die, I die. But he said, you know, that's not everyone's situation. I think wearing a mask is about being respectful of those around you, and so that's what I'm going to do, right? I mean, he basically says, I don't think I'm high risk. In fact, I know I'm not high risk, but people around me might be, and so I'm going to wear a mask and take precautions. Like, I actually think what Kirk said is how a lot of people feel, and I think there's an unselfish nature of what Kirk is saying in terms of, hey, listen, let's do this for everyone else that it makes more comfortable, right? That's how I interpreted it. And so I've kind of been going crazy seeing the reaction of like, hey, this is irresponsible. He's a kind of in a position of, you know, influence and leadership, you know, to so to say, like to be reckless. And like, I don't think that that's what he's doing. I think what he's saying is, look, we need to get on with our lives, but let's be respectful and courteous of everyone around us who may feel like they're more susceptible than you individually feel. I mean, that's how I took it. I don't know if that's how you guys took it, but that's definitely
how I took it. I think you've hit it right on the head. You know, I think when you say, if I die, I die, that becomes the headline. And I'm not sure people read the whole answer to the question.
Right. Like, for me, I don't feel like I'm high risk, okay? I'm in my early 40s. You know, I'm healthy. I don't have any underlying health conditions. But I wear a mask when I go out anywhere, you know, and not because it's, like, mandatory, but because, you know, I may be around somebody that isn't like that. And so, do I like wearing a mask? No, but I don't feel like I'm doing it for me. So I feel like that's exactly what Kirk Cousins is saying. But you're right. I guess we grabbed onto the if I die, die thing. But I also think what he's saying is, look, it doesn't make sense to say you're never going to leave your house. It also doesn't make sense to say, hey, you know, I'm just going to be reckless about this. And I think if more people took that approach, it would be a less divisive issue and more of a, hey, let's hopefully just get this under control so that, you know, we don't all have to just, you know, hide, you know, for the next year.
Tim, I want to get your opinion on something we were talking about earlier about college football particularly. Darren brought up with the Pac-12, if Pete Carroll were still around, a guy that had a ton of pull in college football, obviously it was a different time for USC. Is there more conversation about the Pac-12 and whether they should play or not? And I know the presidents were the ones that voted. They made the decision. But if you look at the SEC, we know that the power of Saban is behind the scenes. We know that in the ACC, it's Dabo. It's Lincoln Riley in the Big 12. How much of a difference do you think that these coaches that have a ton of respect and pull in their conferences and college football overall, how much of a difference do you think it could have made in some of these decisions?
Yeah, I think it could have made a bit of a difference, you know, maybe with a school here or a school there. But I don't think that if Pete Carroll was still in the, you know, in the Pac-12, that was going to influence Cal's decision, you know, president's decision or Stanford's president's decision. I don't think that. It would have done that. And I think that Nick Saban's influence, you know, certainly, and we've heard kind of his position on feeling like the players are safer in the facility. I guarantee you that, you know, has influence at Alabama, but, you know, that's not going to have influence at Vanderbilt, you know, or Tennessee for that matter, you know. So I don't know. I don't think it would necessarily be different. I just know this. I think that, you know, you take the Big Ten, for example. Once they said this cardiomyopathy, you know, long-term issue, heart condition because of the virus, once they said that was an issue and that their medical advisors were basically saying, you know, because of that, like, we need to not go ahead right now, I think it painted themselves into a corner that it doesn't matter what honestly, like what a head coach says at that point. Then it's, I think, this president, you know, a president's decision. And, you know, when that's your medical panel's advice, you know, what do you do with that? So it's interesting. You know, I was on a call with the NFL earlier this week, and they're aware of, you know, what people are saying about that. But I think it's their understanding that there isn't a current link to that. And there isn't anybody that is kind of, I guess, tested, you know, that way or dealt with, you know, that condition, either a staff member or a player since having the virus.
And that'll get better in November or December or January, whenever they decide they are going to do this? I mean, I
that's what I'm saying. I don't, like, can you do that now? It's a little bit like one of these things. It would be like, no, you can't. You know, that's what I'm saying about painting themselves into a corner.
Right.
You know, so basically saying, like, no, heart condition. Well, so now what you have to do is now either that doctor has to be like, I was wrong. I missed it. You know, and then how do you prove that?
Right.
So I think once they did that, once they kind of made that link, and again, this call that I was on with the NFL, you know, one of the things that the doctor brought up was, look, you know, a lot of times viruses, that's what they do, is they do cause there are a bunch of viruses that will cause an inflammation, you know, in your heart. But like making that direct link, you know, I don't know that every, you know, medical panel has come to the same conclusion on it. And so, yeah, I just think it once you did that, now all of a sudden it got really messy. And I don't know that a coach or a player or a parent's petition or anything like that, you know, can absolve you of having that finding and kind of like probably the legal ramifications that you're opened up to because of it.
Yep. Good stuff as always. We appreciate the visit. Look forward to it again next week. You have a good rest of your week.
Cool. All right. See you guys.
Tim Hasselbeck, high noon every Wednesday here on the program, and we always look forward to that conversation. We come back, we should have Titans linebackers coach Shane Bowen join us next on Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Anytime we're talking about Titans training camp, our coverage is brought to you by OsteoStrong Nashville and Wyatt Johnson Ford. Back here on Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game, and we are excited to talk to our next guest. He is the outside linebackers coach for the Titans. He's Shane Bowen, and he's on the line. Shane, how you doing?
Good. How y'all doing?
Great. How's everything gone to this point in training camp?
It's been going good, man. I think we're getting up to speed with the missed time and everything else, so to this point, the guys have been working hard, playing catch-up on all the little things that we missed out on in the spring and early training camp. But, I mean, I'm excited about it, where we're at right now and where this thing's going to be here in a couple weeks.
We had a conversation with Scott Schaefer earlier in the show. He's the defensive coordinator at MTSU, and they're going up to Army to play them on Saturday in that style of offense. But we talked about just, you know, watching Hard Knocks and – just there's no manual for what you guys now have to do on a daily basis, right? None of us have ever had to operate like this, and certainly you haven't had to do this either in your playing days or now your coaching days. What has it been like on a day-to-day basis, you know, going through the proper protocol just to get through camp?
Yeah, I think, I mean, a big emphasis as we started out, everything was kind of in place. We got a great organization here and all the people that kind of went into putting all the signs up, making sure we're spaced out, all that stuff. And really from day one, we just preached it's the new normal, right? So, I mean, the first week it took some adjusting, but now I think it guys go throughout the day without really thinking about it. And we're in meetings and we're in practice and it's kind of, it is what it is at this point. But early on, it was a little bit of an adjustment. But I think to this point, everybody's kind of comfortable with how things have played out and changed in regards to the COVID and all that.
I got to ask you, Shane. Willie's not going to ask you, I'm pretty sure, but I'm going to ask you. So why didn't you go to Vanderbilt? Why did you choose Georgia Tech?
Man, I honestly, the defensive coordinator at Georgia Tech, John Tenuta, who ultimately got me where I am today, I just had a relationship with him. My high school coach knew him from when he was at Ohio State, and kind of build that relationship, and that's kind of where it went from. I'm a big country music fan too, so it wasn't an easy decision, but that's really why, just the relationship with Coach Tenuta and Coach Gailey and that staff there that I formed.
Well, in all seriousness, you've also formed quite the relationship with the head coach, Mike Vrabel, and so how has that been, and how has that worked for you, you know, forming those relationships and, you know, building off that chemistry as coaches, because coaches are just like players, right? They need that chemistry behind the scenes and on the field when you're going through the course of a game or in practice. So how did that all come about for you and Mike Vrabel?
Yeah, I think when I got to Ohio State in 2012, I was his GA. So I was pretty much doing everything he asked. I was learning from him kind of all the details of what he coached, how he taught the players. So he kind of groomed me in that sense into the coach I was even starting out in this deal. So just that familiarity, kind of knowing what he expects, how he would do it, is kind of how I've modeled my career as I've kind of went through this coaching profession. And ultimately, I think now, like, we see eye to eye on a lot of things just because of I was with him with the defensive line. I was with him with the linebackers. Like, I've been around him so much, and even the past few years, just all the secondary stuff coming into play and his input and views, just really being a sponge and soaking it all up and then trying to emulate that in some form or fashion. Obviously, I got my own personality, and, I mean, he's a tough personality to match, but so I got my own style and doing all that stuff. But in terms of teaching and coaching and expectation level and all that type of stuff, I learned it pretty when I was pretty young being with them at Ohio State.
When I found out you were going to join us today, because we haven't had the opportunity to talk to you yet, so I wanted to do a little background on you and learn a little bit more about you. And I'm pretty sure I read this correctly. Were you not a teammate in high school of A.J. Trapasso, who was in Titans training camp at one point back in Ohio?
He was a year older than me, so I was with him playing high school ball. He was a heck of a running back in high school, man. I think he still got all our high school records. And then, obviously, he went on to punt and do his thing. But, yeah, I'm still close with A.J. He was down here last year when they do the alumni deal and bring everybody back. So I got to spend a little time with him there. And then, obviously, Derek Morgan, too. I've had some connections. I played with Derek at Georgia Tech. So, I mean, there's been some familiar faces around here for me. Just in that regard.
And I think you were just starting out your career at Georgia Tech on the coaching side of things when, I don't know if you remember this or not, and Willie and Chase, I know you guys will remember, I think he's the guy that when they first opened up Jerry's World, the new, you know, the big, beautiful facility, which has now been open, I think, a decade down in Dallas, the preseason game for the Titans, he's the one who popped the Jumbotron.
He was the first one to do it. So I think he probably did it on purpose, knowing him.
So that didn't surprise you, huh?
No, it doesn't surprise me in the least. So, but, yeah, it's, and it's crazy, too. We got Milton here. When I was at Georgia Tech, Milton was there, too. So, I mean, there's been some connections coming through here.
Talking to Titans defensive coach Shane Bowen on the line with us here on 102.5 The Game. And Shane, I was reading Joe Rexroad's sort of a coaching tree, drawing the coaching tree out from Urban Meyer at Ohio State in 2012 out to the Titans and Mike Vrabel's staff here with the Titans. I was really intrigued by that whole thing, just the, sort of the football minds getting together there. But what also struck me is the life situation of a grad assistant like yourself at the time. You have to be willing to do just about anything. You know, you have to show the effort, and the living arrangements aren't great. What was the best thing you can say about your living arrangements when you were working for Coach Vrabel at Ohio State?
Yeah, see, I was blessed because I grew up 20 minutes from Ohio State, so I got to stay with my parents. So I got to move back home and do that deal. And I had, obviously, I had a bunch of friends around the Columbus area. But I had that short 20-minute drive. I always had dinner whenever I got home. I had clean sheets, all the above. I think my parents enjoyed having me back after being away for 6 years. So I was blessed in that regard. And honestly, I don't know how I could have afforded rent if I didn't have my parents. I was making $1,000 a month and kind of plugging away. And I mean, that's kind of what you sign up for, knowing that it's going to be like that when you get into this thing.
And weren't there some stories told in there about how there were nights where you would be studying and preparing and you just crashed in the office?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And Stretch, I think Stretch had a bed in there, the whole deal. John Stryker, he was in there all the time because I was the GA, and then we had John. He helped Everett Withers, but he was like the undergrad intern at the time. So they were always in there, and it just goes to show for those guys, and granted for GAs too, but just how passionate those guys were about football. They weren't getting paid. They were around the program doing everything they could to help out, knew they wanted to be involved in football, and the work and the stuff that they did to make not only the coaches but my life easier, and all that just kind of showed the commitment they had to the game and really where they wanted to go with their careers.
And what a great running theme it was to watch as the challenge. You're watching as a young coach, but the challenge of motivating a group of guys who can't play for a championship at the end of the season because of what had happened before with the recruiting violations and what happened with the previous regime. But what a great lesson in mental toughness to be able to overcome that and have a great season.
Yeah, no question. I think that all goes back to the character of the team. I think that team had unbelievable leaders, senior leadership, that were about the right things, about working hard, obviously wanting to get Ohio State back. They had a down year the previous year, so trying to get them back to that level, I think, drove those guys a little bit too. They didn't want to go out leaving it worse than when they got there. But I can't say enough about that leadership of that team. I mean, a few that stick out, John Simon, just because I worked with him on a daily basis in the D-line room, and Zach Bourne, who's actually from my hometown. He actually was a fullback for us, and he came over midway through the year and started at middle linebacker for us the rest of the season. So just the unselfishness, the standard that they had set or they wanted to uphold there, I think drove them kind of to accomplish what we were able to accomplish.
What's different about making a pro player tick as opposed to a college player? What have you learned since you've been in the pros?
Yeah, I think, honestly, with pro players, like, if they ain't motivated, they're not going to last, right? Like, it's so competitive. Like, in college, those guys, whether they're a five-star, four-star, three-star, like, more times than not, they know they're not going anywhere, and if they're really good, they can get by just because they're better than other people, right? Where at this level, like, if you're not motivated, the next guy's coming to take your spot on any given day. So, I mean, in terms of that, it's almost – like, that's not a – it's not as big of a deal here in terms of coach-pushed motivation in my mind as it is in college, just because of the competitive nature of the league.
We're talking to Shane Bowen, the outside linebackers coach for the Tennessee Titans here on Darren Donick and Chase. And Shane, we obviously, when we watch a game or a practice, you know, you see the team and how it comes together, the defensive side of the ball – in your case, but the individual drills that you all run, and you specifically with your group, with the outside linebackers, how important are those? I know that you have the hand drill that you run, that how that translates over to the team portion.
Yeah, I think that stuff's vital. Like, we always talk about, just like in learning from the meeting room to the walkthrough to the practice field, no different than when you're on the field doing a technique and individual taking it to one-on-ones or a group period and then being able to carry it over to team. Because, I mean, the good thing for us, we film everything. So the proof's in the pudding. You can turn the tape on and see in a team period, they're going to be in the same situations that we're putting them in individual periods. And if they're not, then honestly, we shouldn't be doing that drill in an individual period. It's a waste of time, right? Because it's not showing up when we go 11-on-11. So I think it's vital just in terms of development, becoming – it's just like anything you do, the more you do it, the better you're going to get at it, right? So just continuing to rep all those little things, techniques, fundamentals, and especially up front, like O-line, D-line, outside linebackers. Like, it's all about hand placement, how you're taking on blockers. Like, all that stuff is crucial, and it shows up almost every single play.
You know, in this business, we always, at the end of a season, we always talk about, okay, what's next for the Titans? What can they do to be better? Who's a player that's a free agent they could bring in or what have you? But we also focus on who are the guys that they should bring back. And one of those was Kamalai Correa, that he's been here a couple of years, obviously knew Dean's defense from his time in Baltimore. But what have you seen out of this young man that in his growth and just what he brings to this linebacker core, and we've seen him made a huge impact as well.
Yeah, man, I love Kamalai. I can't say enough about him. I was ecstatic when we were able to get him back here. I think kind of as the year went last year, because early on he wasn't playing a whole lot. Like, just things weren't going as well for him. We were rotating some other guys in, and then I think he started to probably focus a little bit more, making sure he was doing his job. And as a result, some things happen. Like, we always talk about, let the defense work for you. Like, don't go out of your way to make plays. Like, they're going to come to you. As long as we're executing the defense, everybody doing their job, like, everybody's going to have their time to shine, right? But the one thing about Kamalai is just his leadership. Like, even coming in, he came in late training camp of 18, and within the first week, I think he knew everybody on the team. He was joking with everybody on the team. Just his personality, like, he's outgoing. He knows when to kind of flip the switch, though, and when it's time to work, he has that physicality, toughness to him. And really, for the room, he's a vet, so to speak. We brought in Vic, but Kamalai's been here with these guys for year two and three now, with Harold and some of those other guys. Like, they turn to him, they look at him, and he's kind of embraced that role. And I couldn't be more excited to have him here still.
And then another guy I wanted to ask you about, he missed last year due to injury in his rookie year, but DeAndre Walker, somebody, you know, we knew from the SEC playing at Georgia. He had that, I guess, the time of being around the team, but wasn't able to be on the field. Now that you've gotten him on the field, you've been around him some, what have you seen out of DeAndre Walker?
Yeah, he's doing a good job, man. He's a strong, powerful kid. Like, he's got some lower body strength that, honestly, it probably saves him from some poor technique at times. He's able to get away with stuff that most guys aren't, because he's just naturally strong and heavy-handed. But the main thing with him right now, like, with all these guys, year one to year two is so crucial. Like, just because year one, you're trying to just figure things out, see where you can help, like, and everything's moving so fast when you're a rookie, right? It's no different than in college when you're a freshman in high school. Like, that first time experience, all this stuff, I mean, it comes at you fast, right? So year one to year two, and I think you saw a little bit with Harold, like, that spring is so vital. And between him and Roby, they missed out on that, right? So we're constantly trying to play catch up, trying to find extra in the technique and all that little stuff too. And they're improving. They are. Both of those guys are improving, but it's going to be a constant emphasis with those guys to get it to the level where it's more consistent, just because they miss that time to kind of build that consistency.
Last thing, Shane, I admitted to these guys that Monday night I watched the replay of you guys against the Ravens in the playoff game. And
yep.
I know how coaches think. I know you guys have moved on. This is the 2020 season. You're not reflecting back. But I just have to ask you, you guys as a defensive unit must have been really proud to know that you were able to, you know, the phrase bend but don't break. You gave up a lot between the 20s, but when it came time to get big stops on fourth down plays or turnovers, you know, Lamar racked up and Baltimore's offense racked up a lot of yards, but they didn't do any damage to you guys. You must have been extremely proud how you guys were able to stifle them pretty much throughout the game.
Yeah, the players bought into the game plan, what we were trying to get accomplished. They believed in it. They went out there and executed it. And when you talk about defensive football, like, the league's built to gain yards and score points, right? It's the nature of the business. We just got to understand, like, when you talk about good defense, if you can be good in critical situations, you can get off the field in the red zone, hold them to a field goal. You can find ways to find stops on third down, whether it's third and 10 or third and one, right? All those create turnovers, which we did in that game. Like, all those stats are vital to defensive success and really being able to win games. Like, the yardage, it's gonna vary from week to week. It is what it is, just based on who you see, what they're doing, all that other stuff. But the emphasis on those third downs, getting off the field, making them kick field goals, like I said, all those things come into play when you talk about the team and how to win games.
Yeah. Well, hey, you're less than 2 weeks away from starting up a new season. We really appreciate the visit. Best of luck the rest of the way, and we'll certainly talk to you down the road.
Awesome. I appreciate it, guys.
All right, that is Shane Bowen, Titans outside linebackers coach. Of course, he's going to be helping Mike Vrabel on the defensive side with play calling and everything. A big year, hopefully, from the defense, and we appreciate him joining us. We'll come back, wrap up the third hour next. Been a really good hour. Tim Hasselbeck, and then you just heard from Shane Bowen, and that was a really good discussion with him. And, of course, all of our training camp coverage brought to you by OsteoStrong Nashville and Wyatt Johnson Ford. So we appreciate Shane Bowen for joining us. Chris Mason coming up to start the fourth and final hour. Anything jump out at you guys?
I was just overall very impressed with Shane Bowen. I thought I would be. That's the first time we've had a conversation with him, but you know, I'd read all these great things about him. I think it says a lot of what Mike Vrabel thinks of him, the way he's elevated that young man at such an early age. I mean, this guy was a grad assistant for a college program, like fresh out of school in 2012.
Yeah.
So it just shows you this: he's come a long way in a relatively short period of time. Compare that with one of our other guests today, who I was also very impressed with, Coach Schaefer from Middle Tennessee. Look at the journey on his career.
Right.
From 1991 until today. You know, he's been in any number of places. But it took him from 1991 until, what is it, 2015 or so, where he became a head coach for the first time. So this guy has been a quick riser in the coaching ranks. Mm-hmm. We'll see what he does with more responsibility this year. But I was impressed.
Yeah, and I was too. I appreciate a coach that doesn't speak in coach speak. I mean, they're not going to answer everything.
No doubt.
It felt like a conversation.
Right,
to your point.
Yeah, but he explains things like the drills and, you know, how the drills apply to 11 on 11, and he goes through and he's thoughtful in those responses. And so I appreciate that. you know, not even from our just our point of view, but just in general. Like if I'm a fan and I hear an answer like that, like, oh, okay, he took the time to explain why that's important and why they do that. It's pretty clear to me that they are grooming him for a bigger role, assuming that is the defensive coordinator. He's going to have a bigger role. It obviously has to translate on the field, but from what I've heard about him, what we heard just there, what I've seen, I mean, so far so good, but we obviously have to see what it looks like this year with an expanded role, play calling, all of that. But I was very impressed.
Yep. He's a fast riser. He's still very young, just in his early 30s. I mean, heck, at 33 years old, I mean, that's safe to say kind of when my career was starting to really get legs and develop and form and kind of take off. And it looks like he's on that path on the coaching side of things. Certainly, this is a big year for him, right? He's going to get an opportunity to do something he's never done. Well, I was going to say on the NFL side of things, really, since he's been a coach, he hasn't had the opportunity to kind of, you know, have a role in a kind of a coordinator position. I don't know how that dynamic is going to work behind the scenes, truly, you know, how they're going to handle game day. But clearly he talked about his relationship with Mike Vrabel. And how crazy was it that he was a high school teammate of A.J. Trapasso?
I know that was a good one by you, because you brought that up, and you know I remember Trapasso for two things: hitting the scoreboard at Jerry's World, and then also in the Hall of Fame game, he ran the fake punt,
which we were at. Or Willie, did you go? I was there. Were you on that trip or no? No, you were not on that trip. Why weren't you on that trip? That was August. The Hall of Fame, when we went down there for the Titans and the Bills, Hall of Fame game.
Well, did they play the Bills? I went to the Hall of Fame shows in 2009, are you talking about?
Yeah.
I was up there. I had to come back because it was Abby's birthday.
That's right, because we went out to dinner with some people you knew in Canton. That's right.
I did, and I this was right before we all got GPS, and I had a very strange trip back from your buddy's house to my uncle's house, in which the cab driver got lost, and we were looking at a map. That was crazy. But I had to get back because it was Evie's birthday.
That's right.
The next day, so I didn't stay for the game, but I was there for all the shows that week. We even took a trip over to see PNC Park, didn't we? That was quite.
We certainly did.
That was quite a
Pirates
trip. That was fun.
And Cardinals, I believe, was the game.
I still need to do that trip, like hit Cleveland and go to the Hall of Fame in Canton, go over to PNC.
Highly recommended. Highly recommended.
We did what? Indians Twins day game.
We did. Thanks to Jensen Lewis, hooked us up when he was pitching at the time for the Indians.
And then we went straight to Canton.
We saw the MAC headquarters with John Steinbrecher, the commish, who was the OVC commissioner.
That is correct.
So we did it all. We did it all.
Action.
A lot of action.
Well, if you remember, that was also right as DeMora Smith was just taking over that post. He had just been newly named head of the PA, and we got him down in Canton to come on the show with us, like at the table with us, if you remember that.
Oh, wow. That is cool.
So that kind of lets you know how long he's been there. I think he had just started. So he was very eager to do stuff because he was the new guy. And I'm not saying he's not eager today. I'm saying back then he was brand new on the post, and you know he was very approachable. Like I said, he may still be today, but that was, over a decade ago. And I remember we just walked up to him in line getting food at right outside the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Just introduced ourselves and just started talking with him and said, hey, we do a radio show in Nashville. We're up here. Love to get you on the show. He's like, absolutely. Just tell me when. And he did.
Hmm.
It was a fun trip. That was the trip. So you didn't stay for the game. Chris Mortensen's kid was in training camp with the Titans.
That's right.
And he threw a completion, and Chris Mortensen was going nuts in the press box, like clapping and cheering, and it was like, ooh. And I said, And the people around me remember this. And this is not trying to be a hater. I'm just saying, after the eruption in the press box, I said, this feels like a pick six coming. And sure enough, the very next play was a pick six. Marshawn Lynch, by the way, was running the football for the Bills that game.
He sure was. Who was the coach of the Bills at the time? Was that a...
Who would have been the coach then?
Was that Marone? Or was that before Marone?
It wasn't Doug Marone by then, at that time. Boy, that's a good one. Jim Haslett, maybe?
So that would have been what? Was that 08 or 09?
09.
It was Dick Geron.
Dick Geron.
Dick Geron. Wow. I was going to say, there was guys, like, speaking of Chan Gailey, right? We just speaking with Shane Bowen. I mean, Chan Gailey, I was thinking, was that Chan Gailey? That was pretty close.
It was right after, that was Geron's last year.
That was Geron's last year, okay.
And Geron, do you remember who Geron replaced in Buffalo?
Replaced, let's see. Well, that may have been Malarkey.
That would have been Malarkey.
He did replace Malarkey?
Yep. Coaching family tree.
Who replaced Greg Williams?
Who replaced Greg Williams?
Malarkey's the one who replaced Greg Williams, who replaced Wade Phillips. That's right. Yep. Wade Phillips, of course.
This moment in Buffalo Bills coaching history brought to you by...
Wade Phillips was on the sidelines.
How did we get started on this?
A.J. Trapasso.
A.J. Trapasso. Famous for one thing.
Two things.
Well, Chase brought up, remember he had the fake punt in the
I remember that play because I just remember Jeff Fisher jumping on the sidelines when it happened.
So. All right, we'll come back. Chris Mason, we'll get a little hockey discussion in with him to start the fourth and final hour of Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game.